Thank you, Torsten. So Torsten, actually many years ago, was my office mate at MIT. And at that time, I was working on completely different stuff. And I vaguely recall him muttering about integral equations and Casimir forces towards the end of his stay there. So something must have sunk in. So I'll explain a little bit later. My background is, I'm a relative newcomer to the Casimir arena. My background, most of my work has been in classical electromagnetism and nanostructured media. So a lot of the focus of this, of my interest in this, has been how to exploit the very well-developed computational tools from classical electromagnetism to do accurate calculations for the Casimir problem. So I'm just mention some of my collaborators. A lot of this work is, I should point out, my student Alejandro Rodriguez, who's a grad student at MIT. Also, done some. The early work was done with Mihai Binescu, who graduated from MIT, and with John Giannopoulos, Professor John Giannopoulos at MIT. And we've collaborated with a number of people on different things that I'll show you here, with Davide Iannuzzi, who I met at Harvard, and Jeremy Monday, who's now, he just graduated from Harvard, is now at Caltech, and Federico Capasso at Harvard, with his experimental work. And we've also done theoretical calculations in collaboration with Mehran, Bob Jaffe at MIT, and Jamal Rahi, who's here, and Saad Zahir, who's an undergrad student with Bob Jaffe, and with Torsten Emig, and also recent work collaboration with Diego Dalvit. So I'm going to divide this talk into sort of three parts, into why, how, and what. And I'll start with some background of why I'm interested in this problem, and some just general review of Casimir force phenomena. Most of you probably already know this already, so I'll go through that a little bit quickly. In that section, I should point out that I've borrowed several background slides and experiments from Federico Capasso, who will be here in a couple of months, I guess. So you may actually see some of those slides, review slides, again when he talks in much more detail about the experiments, I'm sure. And then how do we address this problem, and then what can we do with the tools that we developed? So we'll start with the why, and I'm sure you all know, Casimir back in 1948 made this remarkable prediction that there exists an attractive force between two neutral metal plates, independent of the material, for long distances. And you can interpret this force as a zero-point pressure of electromagnetic waves, of vacuum fluctuations. Although the effect is small, an experimental confirmation seems not unfeasible and might be of a certain interest. And so, of course, it took half a century for that experimental confirmation to occur to high precision. So more precisely, so the canonical case is you have parallel, neutral, perfect metal plates with some separation A. And, you know, classically, of course, there's no force for neutral plates with no external fields. And in quantum mechanics, you get this famous pressure that goes like 1 over separation to the 4th power. And, you know, one of the simplest ways of calculating this for this case is you imagine the ground state energy is in each photon mode, frequency omega, there's a zero-point energy of h bar omega over 2. For each photon has 8, so half the energy of one photon. And the sum over that is the energy. Now, this is infinite, but never mind that's infinite. This frequency depends, of course, on the separation. So in particular, with just 1D, then the frequency is just an integer multiple of pi over a times c. You have to have an integer number of half wavelengths. And so as you change the separation, you change the frequencies, you change the energy, and a change in energy with separation gives you a force. And again, there's some complications due to the fact that you're taking an infinite quantity and differentiating it and getting a finite number, but those things can all be dealt with. So, and you know, there have been, I guess, numerous measurements in the last decade, mainly for geometries that approximate this to some degree. So usually either parallel plates or more commonly for sphere plate geometries with a large radius, you can treat it as approximately flat surfaces. This is an attractive force. It's monotonically decreasing. It's 10 to the minus 7th newtons for 1 micron separation and 1 centimeter square area, so it's pretty small. It's always amazing what experimental guys are able to actually do. And so this is a slide borrowed from Federico, just overview of a bunch of the experiments. The famous first clear observation in 1978, Lamoureux doing the first high precision experiment with torsional pendulums, and then people using a variety of other techniques, AFM, MEMS, and so forth. So he showed me this is a MEMS slide borrowed of an experiment done by Capasso, where you have a plate that can tilt around a central axis, and you bring this thing down, and it feels a force very dramatically visualized there. And of course, you can measure with your piezoelectrics here, so you can measure the tilt of this plate and measure the pico Newton forces. And people have done parallel plate measurements and so forth. And they're able to get reasonably good, for such a small force, it's actually pretty good agreement with the theory. So they if you fit to a 1 over d to the fourth power law, which you can do in the parallel plate case, then they got a constant factor of 1.22 to 10 to the minus 27th, and the theoretical one is 1.3. And I guess one of the main difficulties in some of these in matching up the theory with the experiment is not only that the forces are small, you have to eliminate all the static charges and so forth, but also that as we'll see, the Casimir force depends. Well, as we've already seen, the Casimir force depends on contributions at all frequencies, and so you really need to know the dielectric function at all frequencies, and it's just not necessarily that well characterized for the materials you're using, and also with, for example, gold films, as I understand it, the dielectric constant depends somewhat on the sample preparation. So if you just take someone else's measurements of your dielectric constant, it doesn't necessarily apply to your film. In principle, you should measure the dielectric constant of your film before doing the experiment, which people haven't done, as far as I know. So and it does depend on the difference from actual real gold. This is an experiment done by Mariangeli Zanti at Harvard with Federico Capasso, and so they measure the force with films, palladium films of two different thicknesses, and you get a clear difference in the force as a function of distance, and the difference more or less matches the theoretical prediction that comes from the skin depth that you can prediction. I think these are palladium, PD, is that palladium, right? So I'm not sure of all the experiment. I'm sure if you want to know experimental details, you should ask Federico Capasso when he comes here later. So I'm just trying to give an overview now. So I don't know all the details of all these experiments. But as I understand it, they measured the force, I think probably for a sphere plate, with on the sphere they've deposited, they have two cases where they deposited palladium films of different thicknesses. Of course, if we have a perfect metal, it wouldn't matter what the thickness was, because the skin depth is zero, so it doesn't see anything beyond the first infinitesimal layer. But for a finite conductivity, it does make a big difference, or maybe not a big difference, it does make a difference that's actually measurable. And so the finite dielectric constant really does matter in the measurement of the force. So the only thing is that this force, in some sense, in one sense, it's very exciting, and it's a direct. It can be interpreted as a direct expression of the quantum vacuum as a measurable force. But on the other hand, as a force, it's not. It's kind of boring. It's an attractive force. It's monotonically decreasing. Pretty small. So people have looked for ways to, how can you get the force to behave much differently than this? So one approach is to use exotic materials. So if you can do theoretical calculations, for example, if you have an electric conductor and a perfect magnetic conductor, which you can't really get at the frequencies corresponding to one micron separation, but never mind that. If you could do that, then you could get an attractive force. For example, you can also get an attractive force, actually, if you have three materials, epsilon 1, epsilon 2, epsilon 3, that are where the dielectric constants are in increasing order over a sufficiently wide bandwidth. What's that? A repulsive force, yes. You can get a repulsive force for that case, sorry. And, of course, the only way you can really do that is by having a non-vacuum in between, and so the typical suggestion is to have some kind of fluid. And as I mentioned later, there have recently started to become experiments that have confirmed this repulsive force for, I think, gold, silica, and ethanol. They've also done bromobenzene in Capasso's group. And people have suggested things for metamaterials and even non-equilibrium things involving excited atoms and gain materials and so forth. Another approach is that, well, maybe if you just take ordinary materials and you don't use flat plates, you do some complicated geometry, then maybe you'll get something very interesting. The bad news is that, well, some of the simplest structures have already been looked at, like two spheres or two cylinders, a cylinder and a plate, corrugated surface and a plate, a lot of this in pioneering work by Torsten. And unfortunately, they still give monotonic attractive forces in all these kinds of geometries. But of course, these are very simple geometries. Yeah, I mean, we've just gone from a straight thing to a flat thing, but we don't have any multi-body interactions and so forth. And so, there's some hope that maybe this is not the end of the story. And, this is where I came in, because I work in classical photonics, and there we're used to dealing with much, much more complicated structures. And it's known that in classical electromagnetic effects, you can actually greatly alter them by having wavelength scale structures, but not just wavelength scale, a sphere and another sphere, but typically involving very complex, often periodic pattern structures. You can make, for example, materials called photonic crystals, that are sort of optical insulators. They have a photonic band gap. Basically, they have a range of frequencies where there are no allowed propagating modes. And then you can use that to trap and guide light. And you can, for example, use it to guide light in vacuum. This is an early hollow core fiber that was designed using that, whereas ordinary fibers have a higher index refraction of the core. You can't guide in a hollow core with total internal reflection. But if you surround them with a material that has this photonic band gap property, that the light can't penetrate regardless of the material in the core, then you can guide light in the core. And people are using this for example, for very high power lasers that would melt a solid material and so forth. And you can make even flat surfaces that focus an image to the other side, and all sorts of unusual diffractive effects. And relatively speaking, these are fairly easy to study numerically. These are Maxwell's equations. The theoretical calculations you can do on a computer are practically exact for all practical purposes. And there are well-developed, scalable 3D methods that work for arbitrary materials, arbitrary geometries. And so all we need to do is just calculate Casimir forces and these kinds of geometries, and all sorts of magical stuff will happen, hopefully, right? Unfortunately, it's not so easy. So, as most of you know, so Casimir's original calculation was two parallel perfect metal plates. And by the late 60s, they'd extended this via the Lifshitz formula and various generalizations of that to basically you can handle any planar multilayer structure. Right? If you can, for example, there's a nice formula that just in terms of the reflectivity of these layers, which you can calculate from transfer matrix methods, integrated over frequency. So you have to do an integral numerically, but that's an easy thing to do. You can get the force for basically any sequence like this. And then, progress slowed down quite a lot. I mean, because people did various perturbative asymptotic expansions of these things. You had some small roughness, had some small curvature, and try and see what the correction is. There are a handful of cases that can be solved analytically. The famous cases like the spherical shell or piston cases that I'll mention later, where you have basically boxes. But in terms of handling arbitrary geometries, the things didn't progress very, very far beyond this for a long while. Until there's been some recent progress. And so, in 2006, I think Torsten Enig and Marion Kardar published the first numerical calculation of the force between a perfect conducting cylinder, infinite cylinder, and a perfect conducting plate that's perfectly parallel to that. And coming as an outsider to this field, this is surprising. In most areas, I mean, this is a very simple geometry, a cylinder and a plate. And even in things with fluid mechanics and so forth, we have nonlinear stuff going on. I mean, this would have been calculated 30 years ago. So sort of brings me to the next part of the. And here I'm excluding, by the way, ad hoc, uncontrolled approximations. Of course, people make these just ad hoc models of pairwise. Basically, you treat arbitrary geometries as a sum of parallel plates, and there's no guarantee of accuracy, but it gives you at least some number out, and maybe some intuition for what's going on. But you're never really sure whether it's right or not. And there are important cases where they give you qualitatively the wrong answer. So I'm only considering exact numerical methods. By that I mean, given enough computing power, you can turn, if you turn the crank long enough, you can get, in principle, any accuracy you want. So in most fields, that's called convergence of the methods. It's only because these problems are so hard that people, I think, even consider methods like this where they're not convergent. So it's such a simple geometry, I'm not saying that these Torsten and Maron don't know what they're doing. It's just what this is an indication of is that this problem is surprisingly difficult, right? I mean, just if you look at this geometry, you might think, okay, we plug in a computer, we can simulate any geometry like this, no problem, 2D, perfect metals. But that's not the case. And so that brings me to the second part of the talk, which is how do we calculate it, but more importantly, how can this problem possibly be so hard? I mean, so the simple answer would be, well, it's quantum, and quantum problems are hard to do. But this problem doesn't have any of the usual features that make quantum, many-body quantum things difficult. So, I mean, if you have interactions and entanglement and so forth, then as you add more and more particles, it becomes exponentially more difficult to simulate the system. But these are to a very good approximation, they're completely non-interacting bosons, right? You end up, all the methods, you end up ultimately solving something, some kind of linear Maxwell-like PDEs. And in the length scales I'm talking about, continuum material models are perfectly adequate. We're not worrying about atomic scale effects or anything like that. And so all these methods have polynomial complexity, no exponential complexity here. So it doesn't seem like it's that bad. But there's a couple of caveats. So first of all, yes, it's just solving linear PDEs, but you're solving PDEs at the very least thousands of times, or the equivalent of thousands of times, and often much more, especially in three dimensions. And also, which PDE you solve makes a huge difference. So there's many equivalent ways to formulate the Casimir forces theoretically, and that many of these formulations were developed for analytical calculations. But the considerations that go into developing an analytical approach are very different than the things that go into doing a numerical approach. The things that are easy analytically are sometimes hard numerically, and vice versa. And it turns out that if you look at some of these formulations, that not all of them are well suited for calculations, and some of them make this problem much, much worse than this. And so because of that, reasonably general tractable approaches really have been demonstrated only recently. Torsten has done some work with path integral and scattering matrix methods. We heard yesterday some work on world line techniques, which work at least for the two-dimensional scalar case. And our work was first published in 2007, which I'll describe. So our work is based on, in terms of formulating the Casimir force, is nothing new. It's based on a formulation by Jeliszynski in the 60s of stress tensors. But I don't want to just jump directly to the result. I want to start back at the very beginning and see it as sort of a natural evolution from a numerical perspective starting from the simplest approach. And you'll see, and to give an idea of why, if you're not careful in formulating this problem, it can be actually a very difficult problem numerically. It's still a difficult problem, but it's tractable at least now. But many formulations are actually just not tractable. So we'll start with the simplest approach you might think of. It's certainly the first approach that I thought of. We've seen this formula that U is the sum of H bar omega over 2, and the force is the derivative of this. Well, Now, we calculate frequencies all the time numerically. That's not a problem. So the first thought is, well, let's just compute these omegas numerically. So we'll take we want the force between two objects, and we'll just divide space into some grid, or there's lots of ways to do this. So just the simplest approach we'll stick with for now, just imagine conceptually dividing into a grid. You discretize Maxwell's equations, you solve for the eigenfunctions and eigenfrequencies, and this sum is infinite, but as soon as you discretize it, you get a finite number of modes. It regularizes the problem, so that issue is not a problem. And then you do it once you have the U, by summing this, then you just move these things by one pixel, compute it again, and take the numerical derivative, and you have the fourths. And in principle, this works. And you can even do this in one dimension, quite easily in one dimension. But when you do it in one dimension, it actually gives you, you'll be able to see in a second why this approach is completely intractable in two and three dimensions. So just take this simplistic approach. We'll just say we want to calculate the force between 1D parallel plates. Right, so we'll just discretize space. Now you have to discretize the space not only between the plates, but also outside the plates. Now in principle, I would need an infinite computational cell, but because the force is decaying, we can just, for example, oppose periodic boundary conditions. There'll be a wraparound force. There'll be a force from this on this plate on the other side. But as long as you make it big enough, then that force you can make arbitrarily small. So we'll discretize it with some. In this case, I'll discretize it into 20 pixels. And I'll use 4a on this side and 1a on this side. And you can actually quite easily solve this for the frequencies of this even analytically. You don't even need to do it numerically of this discrete system. And you can calculate, and you can get the right force. But if you plot not just the force, but you plot the contributions to the force as a function of frequency, you see something very bad. So what you see is basically this wildly oscillating integrand, a sumand. It's not really, it's a discrete sum. It's not an integral here. Basically, what happens is the contributions of one side are from this side of the plate, okay, and the contributions of the other side are from in between. And there's a lot more of these because it's bigger, so there's more modes. Right? But as you go up in frequency, you get a bunch of things from one side, and then one thing from the other side, and then a bunch of things from one side, one thing from the other side. And you sum up all these things, and you're left with some tiny remainder, which is the correct answer, which is the correct force. To a numerical precision, and you can make it as accurate as you want. But the problem with this is that two things. So first of all, you need all of these things contribute. So you need all of the eigenfrequencies of the problem, all the way up to the Nyquist frequency of your grid. So if you have n grid points, then that's order n cubed work and order n squared storage. So that's really bad. And you need them to very high accuracy because you need to sum up this wildly oscillating thing and get some tiny remainder, which is the actual thing you care about. Right. And so this is bad. And somehow it's counterintuitive because the intuition is that, well, the things that should contribute most are the wavelengths that are comparable to the separation. But it's not at all visible in this calculation, that it seems like all of them contribute. So this looks like bad news. And this would be, if this were, one perspective is, well, maybe that's just bad news and bad luck, right? That these things are hard to calculate. And that would be the case if these oscillations were actually an observable effect, right? So if you could do an experiment that could actually measure this thing, then really somehow these things would have some physical significance, and we shouldn't really be able to avoid calculating them. But you can't. So imagine how you would do it. Suppose you wanted to measure just these contributions to the Casimir force. What would you do if you could do anything you wanted, right? So what you would do is you would make these things not out of perfect metals. You would make them out of some magical material. And the magical material is a metal in this wavelength range, and it's a vacuum for the other wavelength range. So if you could do such a thing, then the force would just be the sum of this range, and that would be a real observable thing. But of course, you can't do such a thing, and the reason you can't do such a thing is not that coming up with magical materials is hard, is that such a material would violate causality, right? So you can't just make any dielectric function you want. You have to satisfy causality. You know, the dielectric function is a susceptibility. You put a field on, you get a polarization. Polarization has to come after you put the electric field on, and that imposes these Kramers-Kronig relations on the field. So causality really actually entangles all of this stuff together. And so if we want to avoid this difficulty, we have to this is a clue that maybe we should somehow use causality. And we can do that by doing this is a very standard trick, but I wanted to show it to you from, you know, why it's so important from a numerical perspective of a Wick rotation. So the basic thing is this. So we have the sum of h bar omega over 2. We can reformulate that as an integral of h bar omega times the density of states. Right? And the density of states is a trace of a Green's function. The Green's function is the inverse of some operator. And the key thing is that this Green's function is also causal for the same reason, right? Your Green's function is you put a current, you get a field. You better get the field after you put the current on. And causality means that you have no poles of this function in the upper half plane, in the complex plane. And because of that, you can do a contour integration. Instead of integrating over real frequencies, you can close the loop. The integral around this is zero because there's no poles. The contribution from this portion is zero as we make it far away. And so this integral equals this integral. And so instead of computing this over real axis, we can compute it over the imaginary axis. So omega equals iw. And this is actually quite straightforward to principle to do numerically. Because all you're doing, instead of your Green's function normal in the real axis is this, in the imaginary axis, it's this. It just omega squared goes to plus omega squared. You flip the sign. Epsilon omega goes to epsilon I omega. And actually, this is, in almost every way imaginable, this is a much nicer problem than this. Because of the plus sign here, epsilon is, even if it's dispersive and has complex parts, you know, dissipation, epsilon is purely real along the imaginary axis, you can show, and positive from Kramers-Kronig. And so this operator is actually symmetric positive definite. It has no poles, and the poles are what gave you these, you know, this discrete sums is along here. It's a nice continuous thing. And if you know any numerics, real symmetric positive definite linear operators are the nicest things to solve. All the nice methods apply to these kinds of things. Yes? I mean, it doesn't give you. It doesn't contribute. You're right. So I should say it doesn't. It's when you look at the contribution to the force that's zero. Because what happens is infinity, this omega becomes large, it becomes very short range. It doesn't see the geometry. And so there's no geometry dependence of that. So when you take the derivative of theta A, then that contribution goes to zero. Yeah, that's a good point. So, and what happens actually when you do this, and you can do this quite easily, this is in one dimension, again for the parallel plates case. Now, if you plot the force contribution as a function of the imaginary part of omega along that axis, you get something much nicer. It's a nice, smooth, non-oscillatory integrand. It's exponentially cut off as you go to high frequencies. And there's some characteristic frequency that sets your contribution. This characteristic contribution frequency corresponds to a length scale, which is the separation. So the separation does show up, but it's not apparent when you look at the real frequency. It's not apparent when you look at the modes. It's only apparent along the imaginary axis. And this, of course, gives you the correct answer. And this is something now one can imagine doing. So each of these points, you're basically inverting some linear operators. And then we just need to integrate, but it's a nice, smooth integrand, so you can use exponentially convergent quadrature schemes, so you only need a relative handful of these points to get this integral accurately. This is the force contribution, so this is the derivative. This is after I've taken the derivative. So let me sketch out, and the basic reason it becomes nice is because if you look at the Green's function in vacuum, for example, and the real frequencies in three dimensions is e to the I omega r over c over r, something like that. I mean, it's vector, but that basic dependence. And we change omega to IW, this top turns into an exponential decay. So there's no oscillations, and it's exponentially decaying. It's much more short range. And so that exponential decay leads to this exponential cutoff. And the lack of oscillations here lead to the lack of interference, lack of oscillations in this integrand. So, yeah, so how do you, this is much better than before, but it's still really not as good as we would like. So let's imagine how you go about doing this. So what you do is you're going to calculate the energy, which is the trace of a Green's function. Again, you're going to discretize space somehow, right? And that discretization makes this trace finite, so that's not a problem. And then once you calculate this for two different positions, and we'll take the difference, and that'll give us the force. Right? But how do you calculate this? Well, this is an integral of the density of states. Actually, you can connect that to a nice physical interpretation that this the Green's function actually connects this trace of a Green's function connects actually directly to the mean squared value of the electric field from the fluctuation dissipation theorem. So actually, this has a nice physical interpretation that what you're actually doing is integrating up the mean energy density every point. So that's very nice. But it's still rather expensive because each one of these points, each point in space is Green's function from given a current at that point, find the field at that point. That's what the problem that you're solving, and that's one linear system. Okay, and so if you have n degrees of freedom, so n grid points, and you have a good iterative solver, these are sparse systems, you can solve them in order n time, with for example, fast multi-grid solver. But you have to do this at every point, at n points, so the overall complexity is order n squared, which is still, I mean, it's okay, that's you can manageable maybe, but this is still rather expensive for a three-dimensional grid where n could be millions or something like that. Order n squared is not such a good independence. However, this gives you an immediate clue as to how to fix this, because we're not actually really interested in the energy. Energy is not an observable thing. The what's observable is differences in energy or in forces, right? And so instead of calculating the energy and using that to calculate the force, let's calculate the force directly. What is the force? Well, it's an integral of a stress tensor. And the stress tensor, we can calculate in the same way. Maxwell's stress tensor is a sum of you have E squared and H squared terms and so forth. And each of these, the average value you can get from the Green's function, from fluctuation dissipation theorem. And so how do you do this? Well, so now we just pick a closed surface around our object. At each point, I have to evaluate the stress tensor, solving some linear system, and then integrate around this and integrate over imaginary frequencies. But now, since we're only evaluating it on the surface, that's much less than over all the grid points, and so it's much less than order n squared work. In particular, if you just use a volume discretization, it ends up being order n to the 2 minus 1 over d works. So in one dimension, it's actually order n. In two dimensions, order n to the 1.5 and so forth. And we've argued that actually discretizing space is not really the more optimal way to do this. For these kinds of problems, it's more attractive to use a what's called an integral equation method, where basically your unknowns are on the surfaces, not in space. And those, if you apply a fast solver, then you can solve them n log n time, and it looks like the overall complexity might be closely proportional to this. So now that you have, and of course you get the same answer, and it's still a smooth exponentially decaying integrand. Well, I'm just saying it's the number of degrees of freedom. So in this formula, yeah, this would be assuming you're discretizing space. And so it would be the number of grid points in space. Right, so it would be... So then it becomes... then it's going to become hard if you use a volume discretization, if you move them very far apart. But with an integral equation method, that's not an issue. Which is another reason why that's attractive. But to be honest, the most... The difficulty of a numerical method usually has something to do with some longest length feature size over some smallest feature size of the system. Because if you need to capture both in the same grid, then that's going to determine your number of grid points. And so numerical methods work best usually when all the length scales are comparable. So in a volume discretization, this separation is comparable to this thing. In a surface discretization, actually the separation of the objects doesn't matter, but it would be like the diameter compared to the smallest feature on the surface that you would need to resolve. And as long as those are comparable, numerical methods are going to work well. When you have something that's very, very small, you know, compared to something else, then you're going to run into difficulty with numerical methods. For example, if you had surface roughness on this, and you wanted to resolve the effect of surface roughness directly numerically, you know, if you have nanometer scale surface roughness and micrometer scale separation, you're going to have a hard time. Fortunately, those are exactly the regimes where analytical methods work, because if you have some parameter that's very small compared to some other one, then you can use some sort of perturbative expansion. So they complement one another, but definitely you'll always be able to drive the numerics into a regime where you can't do it. So for a spatial discretization, very far separation is going to be hard. For integral equation formulation, that's not an issue, but resolving very small features on the surface will be hard if those are relevant to the physics. Okay, so, and that actually brings me to just a few words on numerical methods. So one of the difficulties in comparing numerical approaches is there's multiple orthogonal axes. And so when you compare, you know, two different things, like, for example, what Torsten has been working on and what we've been working on, very often they differ along more than one axis. So you have to be careful about what features of those things are you actually comparing. So there's basically three major things. So first of all is what equation are you solving? So here we're solving the Green's, an imaginary frequency Green's function to find the stress sensor, right? And there's other formulations. You could, in Torsten's approach, you could ask for what's the scattering matrix? So you have to come in with this incoming spherical wave, and you want to see what the outcoming spherical harmonics are. So that's a different, it's related. It's also related to a Green's function, but it's a slightly different choice of formulation. And then, given that, then there's a huge set of choices in terms of, okay, now we want this computer, we have to discretize it somehow into a finite number of degrees of freedom. And there are many, many standard, well-developed methods, and they all have their strengths and weaknesses. So so one classic approach is finite elements and boundary elements. So there's actually those are so we have some non-uniform mesh, and you can choose to either mesh the space, so you're using a PDE method, or you can mesh the interfaces, and you're doing an integral equation method. There's also spectral or methods which are archetypically using a Fourier basis in some sense, or Chebyshev or Bessel functions and so forth. And these have the advantage that they give exponentially fast convergence. But the problem is that they're somewhat geometry specific. Anytime you have a singularity or discontinuity someplace, you need to take that into account analytically in your basis, otherwise you lose this exponential convergence property. And there's also very simple methods, for example, simple, like the one in the cartoon here, just find differences. You have a uniform grid, meteoric accuracy, you turn derivatives into differences on the grid, but it has one major advantage in that it's really easy to implement a finite difference method. And so guess which one we did first, right? So we, of course, did the simple proof of concept method first, which is definitely not going to be the optimal scheme. We actually have someone working on a boundary element method right now. And then the next question is, then you get some set of linear equations, and how do you solve it? So if you can just throw it at MATLAB, of course, but that's usually n-cubed methods. So there's a lot of, for large sparse systems, there's a lot of fast iterative methods that ultimately the best ones of those give you order n time and storage. So for example, ideal multi-grid methods give you order n. They solve in a number of steps that's independent of the resolution. We're actually using a simple method. We're using just straight non-preconditioned conjugate gradient, which is somewhat worse than order n, but it's still not order n cubed, certainly. Or even less, should be less than order n squared. So given that, well, what can you do with it? Well, I actually showed you the results already for the parallel plates, but that's not very, very exciting. You can do that analytically. The very first test case we did was actually the cylinder and the plate. So it's an infinite cylinder, infinite plate. You can decompose things into TM and TE, Dirichlet and Neumann contributions. And the reason we chose this is because Torsten had already solved this, so he gave us a test point for our case. And this is the very first calculation we did. We're again using a finite difference scheme, so there's actually a big computational cell like this. Because this is an open problem, actually, it's fairly expensive to do. Open problem, I mean open boundaries. It's fairly expensive to do with the volume discretization because you need to do a big enough grid. And there are ways to make that better by using coordinate transformations and so forth, but we didn't do any of that. But it still got within, you know, this is not compared to zero, this is one here, so it got within 3 or 4% accuracy without too much, without taxing our computers too much. And of course you can see the grid as you change the, this is plotting versus the as you change the separation, as you change the separation you're moving it pixel by pixel, and so it doesn't change smoothly, it jumps around as you move this by a little bit, the pixelization changes, and so it's a little bit discontinuous, but you can see the curve, and we had one lonely data point for the TE polarization there. But okay, so it seemed to be working, and I'll show you another comparison against some stuff that we did with Jamal a little bit later, where we have many more data points and it matches much nicer. But once we got the confirmation that code was working, then we wanted to go to some other cases that maybe that hadn't been solved before, and one of the goals is to try and see something that's not a boring monotonic attractive force. Right? So. The next thing that we looked at was actually piston-like geometry. So something called a Casimir piston, which would be two blocks sliding between two plates. And the Casimir piston there's a separation H. The H goes to zero limit, where they're touching, had actually been solved analytically by Scarabucci and Jaffe and a bunch of other people. So we originally looked at this just as another test case. And it's a nice test case for our method because it's these parallel plates basically close off the volume in one direction. So it's a much smaller computational cell. And you can, and then of course you get an attractive force. And we can calculate the attractive force. And we can't really do the H equals zero limit because as H goes to zero, you have to resolve this really small feature size, and so you need a really fine grid there, so it becomes expensive. So I said, okay, let's plot it as a function of H and extrapolate to H equals zero. And when we did that, we saw something pretty unexpected. This is a force, and it's normalized against the PFA force. So just the PFA is just treating these as two parallel plates using the parallel plate formula. So just non-dimensionalized this for comparison. So for large H, it's going to about 0.7. So it's different. Already, there's definitely a finite size of an edge effect, a finite size effect. It's not two parallel plates. Okay. And then as we decrease H towards zero, we want to extrapolate to the, hopefully it went to the analytical result. And it does, actually, if you follow this curve and you extrapolate upwards, it gets, even though extrapolation, extrapolates upwards to the axis, actually it matches the analytical result to a few percent, which is about as good as you can expect for extrapolation like this. But on the way, it does something very unusual, that the force changes non-monotonically as a function of H. And that's, and here we've broken it down into, these are perfect metals, so we can break it down into TM and TE and Norman, Dirichlet-Norman contributions. And you can see that basically they go in opposite directions. And it's the competition. One of them increases the separation, the other one decreases. And it's that competition that gives you this non-monotonic effect. Because the PFA force is just a constant. Because the PFA force, because we're holding the separation fixed. So PFA force is just treating these as two parallel plates. But by PFA, I just mean we pretend these are infinite parallel plates. We calculate the parallel plate force, and then just multiply it by the area of these things. So it's just a number. So the actual, this is just some units for the force. So if I plotted it in newtons, it would still be the same shape, just with a different axis. Yeah, but no, it doesn't depend on the force between these. It doesn't depend on this separation. So here I'm just by PFA I just mean the force between these two surfaces. So which is not dependent on this distance. No, we didn't. Now you can ask what would happen if you tried to include PFA contributions of this, right? Yeah. So in this PFA approximation, I just mean between these two. It does not include these surfaces at all. So it's just something to give the sensible units for the dimensionless units for the y-axis. But it's just a units choice. Okay, so now you can ask whether, well, is there a simple, like, pairwise attractive force that would give you, what if you included the contributions from these plates? Would it give you this behavior? And a little thought convinces you that no, it doesn't. So how would you do a PFA contribution including the contributions of these plates? Well, obviously, you need an interaction between, say, this surface and this surface, right? And this surface and this surface, and they're going to be attractive in PFA. And of course, if you didn't have this plate at all, then just by symmetry, those contributions would cancel, right? So to include the contribution of this plate, so I mean, the usual thing would be some kind of line of sight, so that this basically doesn't feel a force from this. It only feels a force from this if there's a line connecting them that doesn't intersect the other object. So this one doesn't affect this. So this is all ad hoc, but you know, all of these pairwise methods are ad hoc, right? So basically the intuition is that this feels a force from this side. It feels a force from this side too, attractive force from that side, but it's less because some of this surface is sort of blocked from view, right? So that picture would say that the force from the plate on this object is that way. And similarly, the force on this one is that way. And that would say that when you bring the plates in, that should tend to pull them apart, so it'll reduce the attractive force. So that would tend to say that if you start from out here, it should go monotonically down as you decrease the separation. And it fails dramatically in two ways. First of all, it's now monotonic. And the second is when you go to zero, actually the force, the attractive force is actually larger than the H equals infinity force. So bringing in these plates actually didn't decrease, asymptotically doesn't decrease the attractive interaction, it increases it. So, I mean, of course, we don't expect these pairwise models to be accurate in general, but this is a case where it gives you not only the wrong number, but the wrong qualitative behavior. So you can actually get the right qualitative behavior, by the way, with ray optics approximation, with this work we did with Bob Jaffe at MIT and his student Saad Zahir. But there's actually a nice explanation for why this non-monotonic behavior comes about. That we came up in work with Torsten and Mehran and Jamal. So we did a number of other cases. We did not perfect metals. We put in real gold using the real dispersion function of gold, which is no problem at all in a method. It's just okay. It's just a different term that appears in the finite differences, but still a linear system the same size. And you again get this non-monotonic behavior. This calculation and this calculation were originally in two dimensions. By two dimensions, I mean we're going to look at the TE and TM polarization, but we assume that the fields are constant in this direction. So of course, the full 3D case, you need to integrate over all possible wave vectors in this direction, which you can also do, and it also gives you a non-monotonic effect. And then in work with Mehran and Jamal and Torsten, as I mentioned, we did it also for cylinders. So the first thing was just two reasons. So one reason is to check whether the corners are important or whether it happens for other kinds of geometries. And the other reason is that they had developed this very nice exponentially convergent method for cylinders that they used the original cylinder plate calculation. And Jamal generalized to handle any, you know, multiple plates and multiple cylinders and so forth. So they could calculate it much faster than us, very, very accurately. And so there were two cases. We did a case with two plates, and we did the case with one plate as well. The dots are our calculation with the stress tensor, finite differences, simple brute force method. And the lines are their calculation with this exponentially convergent spectral method that's nice and continuous because you're not discretizing space. And now they really do, we have more than one TE data point, and they match along the whole curve and so forth. It's a nice mutual confirmation of the methods. And again, we see the same non-monotonic behavior in both cases with either two plates or one plate. And looking at it more carefully, that there's, so the basic question is, why does the TM forces decrease with H, and why do the TE forces increase as you decrease H? Right, why, and then once you have those two effects, then if they're both of sufficient magnitude, you'll get this, the total force being Hamiltonic follows. And there's a nice explanation for that that Jamal came up with in terms of the method of images. So basically, if you imagine that these were two charges, which they're not, right? Then if you have a metal plate here with Dirichlet boundary conditions, that corresponds to an image charge of the opposite sign. So basically, the image charges will tend to reduce the interaction. So it's as you bring, and that's why if you look at the TM case, you bring in the images, the force goes down. Now, of course, they're not charges, but the same, they really are as Green's function, and the Green's function induces surface currents on these, but those have exactly the same property, that the surface currents have Dirichlet boundaries that you have to put an opposite sign image charge here. It's also really critical for this that we're operating in imaginary frequencies. At real frequencies where things were oscillating, all bets would be off. Because even if you have the opposite sign here, if it's an oscillating, if it sends an oscillating field coming out, it could either add or subtract depending on the separation. But because we can think about this in imaginary frequency where things are much simpler and things are non-oscillatory, if you have an opposite sign image charge, again, this will contribute a force with an opposite sign there. And then, of course, in the TE case, the Naumann boundary conditions, if you look at the scalar field there, which is the magnetic field, then the image charges are the same sign, then they add, and so that's why as you decrease the separation, the force goes up. And then what you can't really show by this argument is that they're both sufficiently large so that when you add them together, you get this non-monotonic effect. But it tells you the origin of why you have two contributions of two different signs. So there's also a nice corollary. So what we're doing here is we're computing the attraction, fx, as a function of h. Okay? So that means we're plotting fx in cartoon form as a function of h, and we see this minimum here. But what is that? Well, that's a point where dfx dh is 0. But fx is du dA, right? But of course, we can interchange the order of these derivatives and say ddA of minus du dH is 0. But du dH is the force fy. It's the attraction between the cylinders and the surface. So that would say that if you plot fy as a function of A, then you also get a minimum and you also get a non-monotonic in the other way. So there's a dual circumstance there. And indeed, if you do the calculation that of the force between the vertical force between these and a single plate as a function of the separation of these two cylinders, that indeed goes non-monotonically, although the effect is much less pronounced than on the other axis, because this doesn't say how strong this is; it just says that there is a zero slope point. So, okay, that's nice, but these are still attractive forces. They're still attractive as a function. They're still monotonic as a function of the separation in the direction of the force. It's just non-monotonic as a function of some third body that you're bringing in. And actually, there's a theorem by Kenneth that actually in any mirror symmetric system with epsilon greater than 1 along the imaginary axis, so excluding some weird magnetic materials and so forth, that the Casimir force is, and assuming there's a separating plane, so they're not interleaved in some way, the Casimir force is attractive. So that immediately tells you why the force this way is attractive, the force this way is attractive, between two planes is attractive, between two spheres and cylinders and so forth. But of course, asymmetric structures, the theorem right now, we don't have any theorem about the asymmetric case, and of course it's quite easy to make an asymmetric structure, and there are lots of interesting things you can have here. So Torsen has done work showing, of course, you would get lateral forces when you break the symmetry, and if you make this asymmetric, then you can get this Casimir ratchet effect that he showed. And so the question is, can you get a repulsive force by breaking the mirror symmetry? And we came up with a simple existence proof, but it's not completely satisfying because it doesn't have a separating plane. So there's still, it's two structures you can pull apart, so they're not like hooked around one another. So you can pull them apart with a rigid motion in the direction of the force, but they're sort of interleaved. So we did a simple calculation, which is you have what we call a zipper structure. Imagine you have pairs, sets of brackets, and they're made of the same material. I've just colored them red and blue just so you can distinguish them. And they have a glide symmetry, so they can interlock with one another. But they're not hooked around one another. You can still pull them apart. And there's a simple, if you look at the cross section, so it looks like this. You have the one brackets and the other brackets, and they pull them together. And there's a simple intuition for why this should have a repulsive force in some sense. So if you just use the pairwise heuristic, which we know might be totally wrong, but if you just use that intuition of there's an attractive force between surfaces, that intuition would tell you when they're pulled apart like this, the force will be attractive. But when they cross over one another, this attractive force between here and here will tend to pull them apart. And of course, as you bring it farther, then this attractive force will dominate and it'll be attractive again. So it'll change sign twice. But of course, this picture might be totally wrong. So you have to do a numerical calculation. Unfortunately, with our method, this is actually quite an easy numerical calculation because you only need one unit cell from here, here, to here. So it's a very small, finite volume calculation. And so again, we break it into two, T and TM, and then the total force. And total force does exactly what you expect. So it's attractive out here. That's negative is attractive. And then it goes through zero and becomes repulsive, and then it goes through zero again and becomes attractive. So there's actually two equilibrium points. This point is unstable, and this point is stable. Stable with respect to displacements in this direction. With respect to displacements this direction, it's unstable. So if you displace them this direction, they'll tend to slam into one another in the lateral direction. So it's not a completely stable situation. No, you would get the point. This is what the qualitatively this matches the pairwise. Yeah. So, but we, you know, you can never be sure. Until you do the actual calculation, because quantitatively the pairwise is totally off for this structure. We couldn't come up with any pair. We tried various different pairwise models, and it's hard to even define them in some cases. And the PFA force, you can get something, but it totally mismatches in magnitude. You can try this Casimir-Polder interaction, which is basically models the surface as an interaction with every point in the surface and every other point in the surface with one of r to the seventh or whatever, and it's renormalized so it gives you the right answer for parallel plates. That's even worse. That actually gives you something. It gives you the sign changes, but the Casimir-Polder actually makes it come in with an inflection point there, so it gives you total nonsense. So we couldn't come up with any simple model that gave you that, which is maybe not that surprising. That the simple models don't give you quantitative accuracy, but even qualitatively you couldn't be confident until you do these kinds of calculations. So, but it's still, in some sense, this is cheating, right? This is it's repulsive, but it's made from attractive forces. It's laterally unstable. You can think of it as being made from attractive forces. It doesn't really have a separating plane in between the two objects, so they're still sort of interleaved. So you can get a true repulsive force in the sense that the repulsive force with a separating plane, as I mentioned before, in fluid-separated plates. And this is first predicted in the 60s. And recently, they started to do... They haven't confirmed it... Well, in 2007, they hadn't confirmed it experimentally yet. I believe they have some results for this geometry now, which maybe Kompasa will show when he comes a little bit later. And it's predicted to play a bunch of roles, and there's some role of similar effects in superfluid wetting and so forth. So, and I said that they've started now actually to do experiments on this, where they basically have a cantilever controlled by piezoelectric that they bring close to another material, filled with a fluid. I think they're using ethanol right now. And what they do is they use they move it at some velocity, and then they use the viscous forces to calibrate the instrument. And then they can measure, and then they use that, compare that against the the repulsive or the or repulsive or attractive, depending on the materials, in order to very precisely match what was predicted by the Lipschitz formula. So, and I said that I don't have the data. The initial publication was for a attractive case, two metals immersed in fluid, and they've recently, I believe, confirmed the repulsive forces. This is work by Jeremy Munday in Capasso's group, who's now at Caltech. And so hopefully you'll see that when Capasso comes. So as soon as you have a repulsive force, then there's some hope that you can make a stable equilibrium. So you get a repulsive force, for example, between silica, ethanol, and metal. And so with electrostatic forces, you could never arrange the charges on this, of course, to have a stable equilibrium. You could think of that as Earnshaw's theorem, but that's not really right, because Earnshaw's theorem is for static arrangements of charges. It doesn't apply to induced charges. So when you have a charge on here, and it induces some charges in the outer surface. So in that case, it's actually possible to get a stable equilibrium, but only if you have the higher dielectric on the inside and the lower dielectric on the outside. So actually with the inverse of this, is actually possible to get a stable electrostatic equilibrium, but not with this, not with the high dielectric on the outside. And you could also maybe consider what would happen in the metal-metal case. And here it's an attractive interaction. Right. So, the intuitive way of thinking about it is that, well, if this was electrostatic forces, then in 2D they would go as 1 over separation. Right? The force goes 1 over separation. And that's basically why it doesn't work, because as you bring this closer, the force between here increases, but then you have more surface area on the other side, and they sort of cancel one another. So that's why the 1 over D forces don't cancel. Yes? Yeah? One sphere alone? Yeah? Yeah, so suppose it's a cylinder or a sphere. So I mean, either way. So again, we're not looking at the force between this surface and this surface. We're looking between this surface and this. A sphere by itself. Yeah, so then that's the prediction. Yeah, so it's yeah, so the question is... Well, certainly, it's a delicate thing, though, because, for example, if you cut the sphere into two halves, right, you might expect that would mean they repel one another, but then the theorem by Kenneth shows that they don't repel one another, even for an infinitesimally thin shell. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's not clear. It's not clear to me how you translate this repulsive force on a sphere to a physically measurable experiment. Yeah. So, the issue that I worry about in applying those results to real, maybe someone who knows the analytical that analytical derivation more in more detail can comment on, is that the question is with all these things is you're calculating the force by the derivative of the energy, so you have to be always careful with those things in what are you holding constant. So for the simple undergraduate examples where that can lead you into trouble, for example, if you calculate the force on a solenoid by the derivative of the magnetic energy, you get exactly the right answer but the wrong sign. And it's because you have to be careful with as you expand it, then the currents have actually slowed down. You have to the current decreases and it slows down just by conservation of angular momentum. And so once you hold all those things constant, you get the right answer. So with the expanding sphere, so as you expand it, something is changing to the shell. I mean, the shell has got to change volume in some way. And I'm not sure what in the how you take that into account in the analysis. And, yeah. Yeah, well, even forgetting the material, but let's suppose it's the metallic shell is actually a metallic fluid. So it's mercury, but it has no, you know, no viscosity, no surface tension, right? So you allow it to rearrange itself, but it can't change volume, right? So even in that case, but it's a finite thickness, and it thins as you get larger. So I'm not sure if that corresponds to the analytical case that was predicted. So it's that spherical case seems rather subtle to me. In translating that, does the analytical model correspond to anything physical? In any case, we're talking about here. We're talking about the force between this and this. And for example, Diego Dalvit has done some analytical. So Dalvit has done some analytical calculations in the eccentric case, and so it is an attractive interaction this way, just like you'd expect from a pairwise model. And we'll show an exact calculation in a minute. Again, right now I'm just waving my hands and saying the intuition. We're going to have to confirm all of this with the exact calculation, but just what is the intuition for this? Yeah, but again, I'm not looking at the force of the outer shell itself. I'm looking at the force of this on this. Right? So all I'm saying is the intuition is that, well, so if it were 1 over d forces, then it would be unclear, because it's like the electrostatic case, they balance out. But since if we think of it as a pairwise force, if that were valid, right, it would decay faster than 1 over d. Right? Then actually, as you bring it closer, this force dominates over this. And so in an attractive case, but if in that pairwise model, that would be unstable, and this should be stable. Okay. And again, this is just the intuition from the pairwise force. We don't know. As you said, there are all sorts of subtleties in this from the finite curvature. The subtleties, as most dramatically pointed out by this analytical calculation of the repulsive force in the shell. So we don't really can't really say for sure from this analytical, this heuristic model. But we can of course do this calculation, and it does in fact conform to that intuition. Actually, I don't have the calculation here for the metal case. That was unstable. But this is for the silica, ethanol, and we use the real dielectric constant functions for the silica and the ethanol, but for computational convenience, we use perfect metal for the outside. So we neglect the finite skin depth there, just because that nicely bounds our computational box and makes the computation smaller. And we did a cylinder inside of the cylinder. We did a square inside of a square. And we can calculate the force as a function of displacement. And of course, just by symmetry, there has to be a point of zero force in the middle. And it's the correct sign to be a stable equilibrium. So that as you move it to the right, the force goes negative, which means, in this convention, means backwards. Right? So it's a restoring force. One surprise, and I'm not sure if this is a coincidence yet, is that the square and the cylinder case have almost exactly the same slope at the origin. Torsten was asking me about this yesterday. I went and checked the numbers, and they're within like 2% of one another in terms of the slope. So what's that? Yeah, but you know, why should those be the same to within two? Because they don't have the same volume. I mean, this is a diameter S cylinder. This is a diameter S square. It's not clear to me why that they should be that close. I mean, certainly if for the same diameter they have the same slope. For example, if I renormalize them so they have the same volume, I should get different slopes. And so why is maybe this is just a coincidence. In this case, but it just was a bit surprising. So we can do the full dispersive dielectric calculation, and you see this stable equilibrium. So it's a stable static suspension. And Kippos proposes for stable suspension of frictionless static bearings and so forth. Of course, as soon as they start moving, you'll have viscous forces, but statically, it's just suspended passively. The nice thing about this, from an experimental standpoint, and people can, you can make little microstructures inside other little microstructures. This is some fabrication of some little moving pillboxes inside of another box. Is that is that if you see this effect, if you see the force, the cylinder suspended inside the other cylinder, you know you're not seeing an electrostatic contribution because that couldn't do that. And in fact, a lot of the electrostatic contributions will be screened out since this is a conductor. It'll screen out on the inside. So it eliminates some of the usual other culprits that you have to eliminate in an experiment if you see the suspension. Yeah? Well, yeah, charge in the inside was still... let's see, so... certainly, a charge in the inside cannot suspend it in the center. Okay, it would tend to be unstable. The charge on the inside would tend to be unstable. So you could still screw it up. Yeah, so some points, you can still screw up the experiment with, yeah, but you know, some state, so first of all, as soon as you see the effect, you don't have to eliminate electrostatic forces in the sense that you know that if you see it, then that could only come from this, right? And certain electrostatic effects are, you know, limited. Like you said, if you have charges in the outer conductor, those will screen. But yeah, it certainly doesn't eliminate all difficulties in an experiment of this sort, but some of the sources of difficulties. Now, the other thing is, as soon as you have the squares, of course, it breaks the rotational symmetry, so you can ask about the orientational dependence. And so, which, again, by symmetry, there should be one unstable, there should be two equilibria, this way and 45 degrees, but whether they're unstable or stable is not immediately clear. Now, the nice thing is we can now calculate the torque as well. Basically, it's just R cross, this integral of R cross, the stress tensor, calculated in exactly the same way over the surface. And so here we found a bit of a surprise. So this is the this orientation. This is the torque as a function of theta for two cases: for silica ethanol metal and for perfect metal vacuum perfect metal. So this is, we expect the repulsive case. This is the attractive case. But for both of them, the this orientation is the stable one. They have the same stable orientation, even though the sign of the torque has flipped. And so it turns out this is a result of material dispersion. So pause for a moment and see. Actually, this orientation makes perfect sense for the metal case, less sense for the repulsive case. Why does it make perfect sense? Again, in the pairwise intuition, the force is going to be dominated by the closest points. And this is attracted to this, so it's going to want to stay in that orientation where it's closest possible, as opposed to the other orientation. But of course, for the metal place, for the metal case, this is unstable with respect to displacements. So, if you look at the material dispersion, this is SO2 ethanol. This is actual gold. Right now, we're using perfect metal, which is just infinity all the time. Remember, in order to get a repulsive force, they needed to be in ascending order. But if you look at, this is along the imaginary frequency axis, the silica and the ethanol actually cross over one another for a high enough imaginary frequency. But a large frequency corresponds to a small length scale. So actually, as you go to smaller and smaller separations, the force can actually switch sign from repulsive to attractive. Now, in the separations we're looking at here, it's not close enough for it to switch sign, but it's close enough for it to weaken enough to that it causes this to be the stable orientation. And you can see that in a couple of ways. So one thing you can do is actually, instead of using the full dispersive dielectric constants, you can just use the static. Assuming it's a non-dispersive material with the static epsilons here, and infinity for perfect metal, and in that case, you get when you plot that, you get the opposite sign. So this you could, you're now two equilibria, but this is now unstable, and this is stable orientation. And that, but that actually corresponds to a different length scale, because what actually where does the static solution comes in? It comes in if you have very far separation. Basically, it's dominated by more and more this length scale. So as you change as you change the, well, let me pause before that. As you change, as you increase the length scale, basically this says that there's a flip from this orientation to this orientation. And you can quantify that by plotting the slope of this point right here as a function of A. A is the scale of the separation, right? And this is the, ignore the dash, the dash curve is a PFA approximation, and the this curve is the numerical calculation. They're totally different scales. This one is on an order of magnitude bigger than this one. But in both cases, yeah, you have, for small separations, it becomes positive, so it has the same orientation as the metal-metal case. And then for around 0.1 microns separation, it transitions to the other stable orientation. It changes into the other sign, and then it goes to this. There's another interesting thing that we actually noticed the other day here, just looking at this data. I should probably wrap up pretty soon, but which is that this static case is actually smaller than the dispersive epsilon. And at first glance, it seems a little odd because it's the static basically case. This limit is where the electric contrast is biggest, so you'd think the force would be bigger in that case. And actually, it's not. In fact, if you look at this plot of the slope over his length scale, as you increase the length scale, the magnitude increases, but then it actually decreases. So actually, what's happening is the material, and the same thing happens in the PFA approximation. So actually, the material dispersion is playing a dual role in this. So at small separations, it switches over from attractive to repulsive. But at intermediate separations, it actually helps this be stable. Because what happens is, intuitively, again, in a simple pairwise intuition, there's sort of two contributions to the torque. There's this interaction and sort of this interaction, and they have opposite signs. And what you want is you might make this one as strong as possible compared to this one. So the dispersion, material dispersion, actually helps the force to fall off faster than 1/a, you know, cubed or whatever it is. And so actually, it helps you to make this, you dominated by this one and have a more stable equilibrium until the length scale becomes so short that it switches over to attractive. So that's why there's this change over here. So I think I'll stop there. And the summary, so the exciting thing about this is that if you go to very non-planar geometries, it's almost totally unexplored. There's only a handful of things that have been calculated. So almost anything you can imagine, even simple 3 or 4 body interactions, has never been calculated. So there's just a lot of territory there to cover where we don't really know what's going to happen. And finally, now we're in a position to start exploring this. We're starting to get exact numerical techniques that are becoming available. And in particular, the approach that we're trying to pursue is to develop techniques that take advantage of these highly developed general scalable techniques from classical computational electromagnetism. And the other point I wanted to make is that not only do we exploit these techniques, but by exploiting these techniques, we actually bring a whole new community in to attack this problem. So if you go to someone who does classical electromagnetism and you ask them to compute Casimir forces and tell them we need a path integral or something like that, they're going to have no idea where to start. If you say, all I need you to do is provide me a black box that calculates the Green's function very, very fast over and over again, then they know exactly how to contribute to this problem. And so, in fact, I've actually pulled in a colleague, Jacob White, in ECS at MIT, who does specialized in integral equation methods. And so they didn't know nothing about the quantum problem, but they know how to make very, very fast boundary element integral equation solvers, and so they can immediately jump into this problem. And we're hoping to have a full 3D solver fairly soon from that work. So I'll stop there. Sorry for running over a little bit, but thank you for your patience. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. No. No, so it's not a problem. So it's a good point. I didn't mention it. So there's two cases. It depends on the numerical method. So there's two basic types of numerical methods. One is a volume discretization, like the fine difference method, and the other is a surface discretization integral equation method. And both of those you can deal with this divergence in different ways. So in the finite discretization, the finite grid size actually regularizes this divergence. Now, because you can say, well, you make the grid size smaller and smaller, that finite value gets bigger and bigger, and eventually you might have overflow problems. But you never go to that high resolution. You never have 10 to the 12th pixels by 10 to the 12th pixels. You have 100 by 100. So the divergence is in the hundreds or in the thousands, right? Which is nowhere near coming to the point of overflowing double precision. No. I mean, double precision is 16 decimal places. You're nowhere near getting close to the where you have roundup problems. In practice, actually, we do actually subtract the vacuum Green's function from each point where you calculate the vacuum Green's function for the discrete grid, which you can do almost analytically. You can reduce it to like one integral that you do, and that's convenient in certain cases where we don't want to actually integrate over the whole closed surface. We want to have just a surface on one side. But it's not at all necessary from a numerical perspective. In the integral equation method, so there what happens is basically you write the Green's function as a sum of two things. It's the sum of the vacuum Green's function plus contributions from all the surface currents. And of course the vacuum Green's function is divergent, but to deal with that is easy, just don't add it in. You can subtract it off analytically in that case, so there's no issue at all. So in practice, the regularization is not the difficulty in these kinds of things. Yeah? Yeah, but not if you want to do electromagnetism. That's not in what you have now. Yes. Yes, I understand. But although in practice you've only done it in two-dimensional cases. You've done spheres, but those are axisymmetric, so they reduce to a two-dimensional problem. Well, again, it depends on the scaling, which as we talked about. So which is not completely clear. Once you throw out axis, once you really have to do with the Monte Carlo integration over all paths in really three dimensions. Clearly it becomes more expensive, and the question becomes, how much more expensive? Okay. So the main difficulty I see is just simply that you're not solving electromagnetism at this point. So I don't want to propose this. It's always dangerous with any kind of thing like this to point to something and say, this is the one true method. Because it's almost never true. Every technique is going to have its strengths and weaknesses. Some things where it works very well, and some things where it runs into difficulty. So, certainly if you're doing spheres, cylinders, and plates, it's way, way faster to do a specialized spectral method for that. And we were discussing with Torsten, there may be circumstances in which you want to use, even if you have this general Green's function solver, it may be more efficient to actually use it to compute the scattering matrix and then use that rather than using it to compute the stress tensor. And it'll all depend upon what exactly you're trying to get out and what the geometry is and what the convergence of this of the multiple expansion of the scattering matrix is going to be. Yes, Jamal? That's correct. No. I mean, it's just a slightly different operator. So right now it's just del cross 1 over mu del cross plus w squared epsilon iw, right? So there's just an extra term inside the curl. So and actually we do that in other cases for classical electromagnetism. But here I didn't bother to put it in, and the reason is because the magnetic susceptibility is almost always very close to 1 at once you get down to infrared length scale. So once you get down to micron separations, it seemed unlikely that this would ever play a role. But it's not really any conceptual difficulty. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they mix up. There's still a splitting into not Dirichlet-Neumann, but into T and TM polarizations at KZ equals zero. Okay, and what happens is the contributions, so they have the right signs at KZ equals zero, because you have to integrate over KZ, but things decay but the contributions decay exponentially with KZ, just like they decay exponentially with frequency. So as long as, depending on your how strong the effect is, as long as it's strong enough, basically, it'll decay away in KZ before the mixture spoils the effect. It'll depend on the material. So if the effect, for example, if the non-monotonic effect is very weak to start with, at K is equal zero, in the 2D case, then I could see it being spoiled when you integrate over KZ. So I guess we can, if there's further discussion, we can continue over lunch as well. So thank you again.